This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney.
There are two kinds of ethnostates. There is the first kind is a kind of ethnostate that exists all over the world. In fact, the United States was effectively an ethnostate. One of the first pieces of major legislation, the 1790 Immigration Act, limited immigration to the United States to white people of good character. This country was effectively racially defined from the very beginning. It's nice to look back at some of the heady... I promise I will answer this.
White nationalist Richard Spencer could be speaking at the University of Cincinnati with a proposed date in March. But many think that Spencer and others like him who engage in provocative or hateful speech should not be allowed to speak on college campuses. A recent survey by the Newseum Institute found that 43% of respondents feel that colleges should have the right to ban controversial speakers. But the First Amendment protects even offensive or hateful speech. And here to discuss speech protections and the First Amendment are Sana Hassan, who is staff attorney with the Council on American Islamic Relations Cincinnati, Hamilton County Municipal Court Judge Fannin Rucker, attorney with the Graydon Law Firm Jack Greiner, who represents Cincinnati Public Radio and other local news organizations and First Amendment issues, and Dr. John Paul Wright, who is professor in the University of Cincinnati's School of Criminal Justice. And you can join the conversation, 513-419-7100, email talk at WVXU.org, or find us on Facebook or Twitter. And I'd like to start, we conducted a quick online poll, and the question that we asked was, is hate speech protected under the First Amendment? And the results that we got were that 63% say it is protected, but 37% say it's not protected. So I'm wondering, Jack, what does the Supreme Court say about hate speech and offensive speech?
Well, it depends on how you define hate speech. I think the panel, the survey takers probably were defining it a little more broadly than perhaps it should be, but because they're partially right in the sense that a true threats, for example, which would be a subset of hate speech, do not get First Amendment protection. So if somebody, you know, literally threatens someone with physical harm, that is not protected First Amendment speech. However, I think that when people hear the term hate speech, they may bring under that umbrella hateful speech, which is different. So that if the types of things that Richard Spencer says, which are hateful, probably are protected speech under the First Amendment. So it really depends on what subset you're talking about, but it's a narrow subset. And to be a true threat, one that is not protected by the First Amendment, it really requires imminence. In other words, that not only am I threatening you, but I am doing it in a manner that is the threat of the harm is imminent and my ability to carry through is equally imminent. So if there's some time or space distance, that affects it. But that's really what the Supreme Court has to say about it.
Sunday, so if I give a speech that's inciting people to violence, that's not protected.
If you're inciting people to violence, no, it would not be protected. Like Jack said, it has to be the imminence of harm. So if you're yelling and saying, you know, kill all Muslims, then that is something that is inciting violence. And probably most likely that would not be protected speech. So as an attorney for the Council on American Islamic Relations, we receive a lot of calls. There was a surge and spike in calls in 2016, incidentally, right after the campaigning of 2016 began, where we were getting calls in which people were being told to go back to where they came from. We received a call where a refugee family had go back to your country spray painted on their door. So although something like that would be considered hateful speech, unfortunately, since it's not a threat, since it's not something that has imminence, that has a direct threat, that is something that would most likely be protected and something that the police, when called, could not take immediate action against.
There's also a Judge Rucker. They're what are called fighting words. Are those protected?
Fighting words are not protected in the same vein of what's been discussed so far, and that is words that encourage, inspire, or cause others to a violent response directly. Actually, there's a code section specifically prohibiting that. But it has to be viewed in the context of the time, place, and manner that those words are actually spoken. Because anyone subjectively can decide that I'm inspired to a violent response because of what someone says, but it has to be viewed based on the other attendant circumstances before that can be determined to be illegal.
And Dr. Wright, so how do you define hate speech? It sounds like it can mean a lot of different things. Is this sort of like what Justice Potter Stewart said about obscenity? I know it when I see it.
Well, that's the inherent difficulty, right? That who gets to define what constitutes hate speech and where do we draw that line? It's substantively meaningful because we can draw that line fairly broadly or we can draw it in a way that's fairly narrow, but we are going to exclude conversations and people that sometimes have opposing viewpoints and coincidentally sometimes that are have correct viewpoints that we do not wish to hear. I'm not saying that about Richard Spencer. I'm saying this as a consequence that immediately comes out of limiting speech.
513-419-7100. If you'd like to join the conversation, or you can email us talk@wvxu.org. Jack, is that one of the difficulties in this whole thing is defining what hate speech really is?
Well, I think, but I think the courts have tried to put some fairly objective standards around it when they talk about does the speech call for some sort of violent response? Is that violent response imminent, and is it made in circumstances where it could be acted upon? So, for example, there was a controversy. It's been a number of years now, but the comedian Chris Rock was on the Today Show, and he made a comment about people getting, basically taking Ken Starr out. It was a bad joke, but that's protected speech because Chris Rock is in a studio in New York. He's not in the middle of an angry mob. There's no imminence to that threat at that time. And that's, to me, that's a fairly objective standard. And I think if it's applied properly, what I think frustrates people sometimes is that if properly applied, it would narrow prohibited speech to a very narrow band. But I think that's the intent. I think that's what the Supreme Court has intended it to be. But I would say that, you can look at the speech, you can look at the surrounding circumstances, and it's not as ambiguous as one might make it seem. I mean, is it an angry mob that's about to go act, and are they in a position where they can act on what the speaker's saying? I mean, to me, that's, it either is or it isn't. And so things like time and distance from the action make a difference and should under the case law under the First Amendment.
And Judge Walker, what about nonverbal symbols? Something like a swastika, for example, is that protected speech?
Well, I can give you a legal answer and say it depends, and that it depends is contingent upon a lot of those other circumstances. If a swastika is being displayed on a board at an art museum, does that reasonably argue to incite violence? Well, no, someone could argue it's an artistic expression in the venue that is being displayed, or it's a demonstration of what history has done, or symbols that have been used throughout history. But if at a synagogue, a person gets up in the middle of that synagogue and displays a swastika in a way that suggests to those who are present that there is about to be some incident that is going to occur, then by all means, their action itself will be considered to be violative of standards of conduct and will likely get them arrested.
Yeah. Dr. Wright, did you want to add to that?
No, I think we also need to be aware that the focus narrowly on speech, we need to be aware that it includes other forms of speech, publication, writing, music, artwork, as Judge points out. Many times we've encountered situations where art, for example, or certain genres of music are very, very provocative, oftentimes quite challenging to deal with, and they elicit very heated responses. It's protected. That's protected speech as well. Burning a flag, an American flag. Many Americans dramatically object to burning a flag for what it represents. It, too, is protected speech. So the boundaries here are, I think Jack nailed it, very, very narrow and for good reason. Because the more you expand in other areas as well.
And what you're talking about is freedom of expression, then, I take it.
Yeah, expression comes through many mechanisms.
Which is interesting, bringing up the point of the burning of the flag. Mm-hmm. That is a perfect example of the type of speech that can be viewed in different lenses. Because in certain contexts, burning the flag is considered anti-American, is considered, I mean, everything horrible against what our country stands for. But the military says the only proper way to get rid of a flag mm-hmm. is to burn it.
So we're back to the it depends situation then.
it's the time, place, manner, and circumstances under which that speech is actually given.
So, Sano, as vile and offensive as hate speech can be, why is it protected?
I think it's protected because under the Constitution, we all have the right to freedom of speech, to express our ideas, to express our beliefs, even if they are offensive to others, so long as they are not harmful and threatening in a physical manner to others. I think we want to protect speech, even if it's found offensive by others. Being someone who is a representative of the Muslim community, I know that the hate speech that has started in 2016, that it has had very tangible effects on the Muslim community in specific, other communities as well. But representing the Muslim community, the hate speech has had very tangible effects in the way that children are being treated in schools, in the way that Muslim men and women have been assaulted, attacked on the streets. So although I am in favor of freedom of speech, the specific type of hate speech, especially the speech that has been emboldened by our political figures and individuals like Richard Spencer, who've used this speech to gain prominence, it has caused specific violence towards many members of our community.
And we're somewhat unique. Other countries are enacting more laws against various forms of speech, including writing and entertainment and art.
Mm-hmm. Yes. So the United States is still pretty broad in the sense in allowing hate speech. For example, Europe does not protect hate speech. So the United States has still allowed hate speech. The courts have, although they have placed restrictions on hate speech, it's still largely protected. I'm curious to see the change that will occur going down the road with the serious rise in hate crimes with the annual report done by the FBI that showed that targeting of Muslims has doubled from the years 2014 to 2016, the first time that this has happened in a decade. So I'm curious to see the steps the courts will take to address that.
And we will continue our conversation. You can join us, 513-419-7100. You can email talk@wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition, and here to discuss speech protections and the First Amendment are Sana Hassan, staff attorney with the Council on American-Islamic Relations Cincinnati, Hamilton County Municipal Court Judge Fannin Rucker, Jack Greiner, attorney with the Graydon Law Firm, and Dr. John Paul Wright, who's professor in the University of Cincinnati School of Criminal Justice. You can join us at 513-419-7100, email talk@wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Chris called us earlier, and he wanted to know if someone can speak on a campus, is there any legal reason that a university can't give them a small room versus an auditorium?
Well, yes, there is a legal reason why they can't do that. It's the First Amendment. Again, important to note, this discussion applies only to state universities.
Right.
Okay, because the First Amendment only deals with state action. So Xavier University, Mount St. Joe, could do what they want, including prohibiting certain, you know, speakers. But if that the potential problem with what Chris described would be if the decisions about room size and auditorium size are made on the basis of the content of the speech. That's the problem. And, you know, so the idea that we'll take a controversial speaker like Richard Spencer and stick him in a small room so we control the crowd size, when we allow, you know, Professor Wright to speak, you know, at the Shoemaker Center, that's a problem. So the short answer to that question is yes, that would be a problem.
With Supreme Court, there wasn't a ruling that said that public institutions, governments can control time, place, and manner. They can set those kind of restrictions on speech.
They can, but and so they could decide that, you know, in the interest of safety, all speakers are going to be, well, they really can't even do that, actually. I'm getting ahead of myself. I mean, but I suppose that I think if the guest speaker venue on a campus was designated to be X auditorium and every speaker spoke at that auditorium, I think that would be a time, place, manner restriction that would probably stand.
So it has to be equal, it sounds like.
Content neutral.
Content neutral. Okay. It has to apply regardless, right?
What do you see on campus, Dr. Wright? And what do you hear from your students about this issue of free speech on campus?
A lot of concern, legitimate concern, and various opinions about potential harm that could come out of this, about whether or not Spencer's message conflicts directly with the efforts of UC to be a welcoming and inclusive place, as well as people saying, look, you know, we have to allow Spencer because we allow everybody else. And other people, so that are also quite provocative, and that maybe people in the public would disagree with, are also brought to campus and given a forum. So it's really enlivened debate in a lot of ways, and I think overall that's a good thing. I think the initial response of UC not to automatically turn down Spencer was positive, even though it set in motion conflict. Sometimes that conflict is healthy. The debate that we had yesterday was interesting. That there are core segments on campus that absolutely do not want Spencer here and have a line of justifications, some of which I can understand, but which clearly are would not pass constitutional muster. But beyond that, let me just argue that the university should be the epicenter for free speech debate. And part of the reason we've got Richard Spencer and so much conflict is because universities have had a very difficult time and have in some places been quite unwelcoming of free speech. So this in some ways can be a positive outlet to those broader debates.
But wouldn't students and faculty have a right to speak out against somebody if they disagreed with them? Wouldn't they, as part of their free speech rights, also be able to say, I think you're wrong?
Absolutely. The beauty is the engagement, that we get to engage people and ideas that we disagree with. And as I told the audience last night, if you're upset about Richard Spencer, you have choices to make. A, don't go. Right? Go home and talk to your children about what he represents and how that harms the United States, or go read a book on the First Amendment, or go and protest legitimately in a way that's nonviolent. Those are essentially the options that we have available to us.
Yeah, or go and help formulate your reasons for opposing it too. I mean, I think you really have to understand the position of the other side to really effectively rebut it.
Correct.
You know, so I think that's another option.
Mm-hmm. But where would you draw the line, Jack? Would you say there's a difference between disagreeing with somebody and speaking out against them and just trying to outright shut them down or ban them?
I think there's a clear line there. Yeah, and I think that's what the First Amendment enshrines, I think. But it makes it tough. I mean, it's You know, there's a line in the movie Remember the Titans where Denzel Washington tells his team, you know, the other teams in this league aren't integrated. They don't have to worry about race. We do. You know, it makes us better for that. So other countries don't have the First Amendment. We do. And it makes for messy, tough debates and discussions. But it makes us better for it. But it's hard. I would not pretend that this is an easy issue. And people like Spencer push it to, I think, the edge of the envelope. And it's tough.
Yeah, some people, though, would point to the dangers of free speech. They point out Charlottesville, for example.
Sure.
Say, look at what happened in Charlottesville. You had a woman lose her life. Yep. You had all this violence. Yep. And some people would point to that and say there are dangers with this.
Absolutely. Especially with the Muslim community, I think there is a lot of fear. I think there's a lot of concern with what hate speech is capable of doing, especially with the last year being one of the worst years for hate crimes, with hate crimes rising. Speech like this, although it is protected, it emboldens individuals who are violent to translate their hatred into abuse, into violent acts. So there's although speech is protected, although there is benefit in that, there is real concern as to what that could mean for not only just the UC students, Muslim students that are on campus, Jewish students, any minority students, but what it could mean for the Cincinnati community at large.
Again, 513-419-7100. If you'd like to join our conversation, Jack, did you want to add?
Well, I mean, I'll tell you, I'll put in a plug for the organization that's putting on the event tomorrow night, Beyond Civility, because I think that the mission of Beyond Civility is to help people have these discussions in a reasonable, rational, peaceful way. You know, people have said, I think it was Oliver Wendell Holmes that said antidote to hate speech is more speech, not less speech. So we need to have these conversations. We need to have these discussions. And again, a little plug for Beyond Civility. That's what this organization is really trying to promote.
Yeah, Charlottesville, in the minds of a lot of people, was a turning point for them. That they saw the damage and the loss of life, and they were horrified by that. But let me suggest that Charlottesville was not a failure of the First Amendment. Charlottesville was the failure of local officials to correctly and properly segregate groups, as other cities have done in the United States when these have arisen. And the local officials were, I think, largely responsible for what happened there. Other cities easily managed these types of incidents, right, without property damage or loss of life. Mm-hmm. So the First Amendment, yeah, it's messy and it's tough and it makes for very uncomfortable conversations. But let's also look at what Europe and Canada have done. There are people in prison now for Facebook posts. There are people who've been criminally held liable for tweets. And we have to remember that if we're going to start cranking down and invoking legal reactions to what people say, that is the consequence that we're going to, that we could easily track, just like our European and Canadian brothers and sisters are doing. That to me is a worse outcome.
Judge Rucker, what do you think about that?
Well, as he was saying that about people in jail for Facebook and Twitter posts, I was thinking, I actually think I put a couple people in jail for Facebook and Twitter posts. Yes. Such as there was a young man who appeared in front of me some years ago who over Facebook threatened to shoot up his school. And it was 2 days after Sandy Hook. So he was arrested for inciting violence.
Right. That's not a protected form of speech there.
That is not. But that was a Facebook and a Twitter post. Now, I assume that what the professor is talking about is people saying I object to the government's position on free speech, perhaps. And so that's what caused in other countries people to be arrested. But in our country, true. If you put someone else in the position of fear, specifically and directed, then you are at risk. People seem to think, and I used to teach a law history class, and I used to practice civil rights law and constitutional law. And what people would come to me and say, well, I have a right to say, I have my First Amendment rights. The First Amendment right to free speech is not absolute. You do not have the absolute right to say whatever you want to say. There are most certainly consequences. And then there's legal consequences, and then there's practical consequences. In court, we deal with the legal. Outside of court, people deal with the practical consequences.
Yeah, you hear the old expression, and I'm not sure if it's 100% accurate or not, but the old expression, you can't yell fire in a crowded theater. Is there some measure of truth to that expression, Jack?
Sure, that would be inducing panic.
Yes.
You know, I think that the
unless there really is a fire.
Well, of course, yes. Of course. And again, that comes back to context and circumstances. But I mean, I think that, you know, what the our courts have sort of focused on, I think, is how much of an action element is there involved. That's a pretty key consideration. So, if you do yell fire in a crowded theater, you are inducing action, and it's the action that you induce that's harmful. If you are truly inciting an angry mob to go, you know, burn down a building, it's really the action. If that same speaker were giving on a panel and said, I think that in proper circumstances, you know, violent resistance is perfectly appropriate, and if that includes property damage or even, you know, physical violence, I say that's great. That would be protected speech, you know, again, because he's not directing an angry mob to go do it. He's expressing the idea, again, an idea we might find distasteful and hateful, but that speaker has sort of moved away from the action element. And I think that's an important consideration in, you know, our First Amendment jurisprudence.
513-419-7100 if you'd like to join the conversation. And Paul joins us now. Hi, Paul.
Good afternoon, and thank you for taking my call. I think one of the, or maybe two of the panelists have expressed something very similar to my view, that within the context of the legal restrictions that have been explained so far, there may be times that I would want to go to judge for myself the speaker's argument. But I think for me, even more important is that other people be allowed to go to judge the speaker's argument for themselves. So I'm not interested in going to hear many of these hateful things, but I think other people should be allowed to judge for themselves. And again, thank you for taking my call, and I'll listen to your response on the radio.
Okay. Thank you, Paul.
I agree 100%. Yeah, I don't think there's a lot of debate that's here. Right. Although
yeah. I think Dr. Wright, you really agree with that.
Absolutely. It's called the heckler's veto, and it's something that universities have had to deal with, where people have been invited to give a talk or attend a debate, and others show up with the express purpose of shutting it down. So there's no talk, there's no debate. Well, not only is that censorious, but it deprives other people of the right to hear what these people were going to say and to form their own viewpoints. So it's not simply that we're going to shut down one person. We're going to shut down the ability of everyone else to listen.
I'd like to play devil's advocate real quick.
Be my guest.
Based on the work that I do, what Jack said, although there is not an imminence with hate speech, you can't pinpoint and say that the hate speech that's being emboldened by an individual, for example, saying that all Muslims should be shot with bullets soaked in pig blood, right? We can't point to say that this specific action caused a specific reaction. The words that we use, they matter. They have consequences. Whether they're used on a campaign trail, on the floors of Congress, in all of our living rooms, I think they matter. And they directly impact our ability to sustain a society that ensures liberty, equality, and dignity for all of us. So, like I said, I think I'd be really curious to see how courts would react to situations where, although you can't pinpoint that this speech is causing a direct reaction, what about the surge in hate crimes, mosques being vandalized, houses of worship, whether it's a synagogue, any house of worship being vandalized, being burnt down, those effects happening after hateful speech, after our political figures or president spewing hateful comments, how that is going to be reconciled.
We will continue our conversation. Actually, let's go ahead and take another call. We have a few minutes here left. So let's go to David. And hi, David. Go right ahead.
Hi, good afternoon. Great discussion. Thank you. My mother was a Holocaust survivor. She passed away about a year ago, and she lost her parents to the concentration camps. Many years ago, I ran into Jerry Springer when he was our mayor, and there was a big discussion about the KKK putting something on the square.
Yeah, the cross. And Jerry, yeah.
Right. And Jerry said, no, I'm all for freedom of speech, but some things just don't constitute speech. When I went home and I told my mother, I expected her to be thrilled. Instead, she said, he's wrong. I go, he's wrong? How can you say that? She said, if you suppress stupidity, bigotry, hatred, it will grow, and you will never know it. And I think if we look back at the recent election, I think we've proven that. I think people are shocked by the intensity of the bigotry and the hatred. And my mom was right. It grew, and we didn't even know it.
David, thank you. We appreciate the call.
Thank you.
Yeah, it's an interesting comment, interesting anecdote that he shared. But I think that, you know, I guess true. I think there's a couple of things that are going on, particularly around campus speech, that are sort of clouding the analysis. And one is, I think, a sort of joining together in some people's minds of hateful thought and hateful speech. And sort of saying, okay, if you've got a hateful thought and you express it, that's hate speech, which, and some people go so far as to say, and that can be regulated because it's hate speech. And I think that is just not consistent with what the First Amendment means and what courts have interpreted the First Amendment to mean. The other thing that I see going on with campuses, and I think Dr. Wright could probably talk to this even better than me, but is this idea that by having if a speaker comes to a campus who could be invited by and probably is invited by some subgroup of the campus, you know, whether it's whatever, that constitutes the school giving that person a platform and endorsing that person's point of view. And again, I think that's just not correct. But I think if you talk to a lot of students, they'll express that thought, won't they?
Yeah, you do hear that. If we have Spencer, isn't this sort of a tacit endorsement of what he's saying? My answer is that of course not. We have lots of speakers that come on campus. Many of them hold opinions that are sometimes quite radical, sometimes quite provocative. That's part of the educational experience, is to be exposed to a very diverse range of views, some of them quite offensive, by the way. And that doesn't mean that the university or even the professor who may have sponsored this person to come in and give a talk endorses those views. It's oftentimes driven for an educational purpose. Well, I'll leave it at that.
Well, Chris's email kind of fits with what you're saying, Dr. Wright. He says that free speech does not enable neo-Nazis. It destroys them.
Yeah. Suppression has never worked. And this is, you know, free speech is the great equalizer. And because you get to engage intellectually with people dissimilar from yourself. You get to expose the limits of their argument. You get to learn the limits of your own. It has, over time, I think, proven to be a mechanism for positive social change. The civil rights movement would have never happened had people not been provocative and stood up and challenged in very entrenched views. And if memory from what I've read and so forth serves me correctly, many of the local organizations, county sheriffs and so forth in the South at the time, used the very same types of arguments that we hear today to limit speech. That it's provocative, that it will incite violence, that it will affect community standards and so forth. So we have to be very careful. Malcolm X was provocative, right? Robert Davenport, provocative, and for good reason. That is sometimes how we change.
We will continue our conversation, and you can join us at 513-419-7100. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Caney. Here to discuss speech protections in the First Amendment are Sunnah Hassan, staff attorney with the Council on American Islamic Relations Cincinnati, Hamilton County Municipal Court Judge Fannin Rucker, Jack Greiner, attorney with the Graydon Law Firm, and Dr. John Paul Wright, professor in the University of Cincinnati School of Criminal Justice. You can join us at 513-419-7100, email talk at wvxu.org, or find us on Facebook or Twitter. And let's talk to Mark. Hi, Mark.
Good afternoon. Thank you for taking my call. It's been a great discussion regarding free speech. Yes, my question is, given the internet and the ability to network with like-minded individuals, how effective have we been to curb unprotected speech that gets emphasized, encouraged, and planned through the internet? I can't believe but that some of the disasters that have happened have been a coordinated effort that the internet, in fact, has helped breed and encourage. And how effective have we been to try to curb that? It's, as opposed to free speech, which is face-to-face. There's a limited space involved. There's a finite area. I've attended the Beyond Civility, which is a wonderful program, but it's also voluntary. And anyone who wants to be hateful simply doesn't have to go. Thank you for taking my question.
Okay. Sunnah, you were sitting there like, shaking your head that day. You look like you've got something you want to say.
Yeah, I think a lot of us on social media, we tend to be friends with people who share our views, people who tend to think similarly on a lot of issues, especially with me. I'm friends with my law professors, my friends from law school, and most of them share the same views that I have. So I think free speech on the internet only happens once you expand yourself to views that, you know, reading articles that you wouldn't normally read, going on sources that you wouldn't usually go on. So attending events like these, I think, where you might not agree with things that are being said, open you up to different viewpoints, which is an argument with free speech that I would agree with. Because social media is so limited to our own views, so we don't generally tend to see a lot of free speech happening online unless you go out and you expose yourselves to ideas and resources that you wouldn't normally see on your own feed.
He was asking too about how effective is it to control speech on the internet, Jack?
Well, the answer would be the First Amendment applies to whatever the format or the platform. So I guess the idea of controlling speech on the internet would be problematic in the face of the First Amendment. It's also, I will say that Congress in 1996 passed a law called the Communications Decency Act, where Congress really made a policy decision, which was to answer the question effectively, you know, what exactly is the internet for speech purposes? If you buy a book at a bookstore and the book contains, you know, libelous material or whatever, you don't sue the bookstore. The bookstore is not typically a defendant in the libel suit. However, traditionally, if a letter to the editor was printed in a newspaper and it libeled somebody, then the newspaper would get sued for that and could be responsible for that. So Congress was really kind of faced with, is the internet like a newspaper or is the internet like a bookstore? And they opted for the internet's like a bookstore. And that's really what the Communications Decency Act says, which is that if you operate a website, and that could be Facebook, that could be, Snapchat, Instagram, you name it, or a blog, and third parties supply content, Congress has ruled that the host is not responsible, is not the publisher of that third-party content. So effectively, only the third-party poster, who may be anonymous,
it's the person who actually wrote the
material.
That's
it. Okay. So there's no liability for the hosting site. And there are some people that would argue that creates problems, that has created an atmosphere where there's less responsibility, not so much from the government, but from Facebook or whomever, to really police their sites. tough issue again. And that's less a First Amendment issue than it is just a policy issue. But that is, you know, it's 22 years old, and I think it's it, you know, people occasionally make noise about it. And right now, Congress is debating whether to limit it. There's been some contention that it needs to be altered to prevent sex trafficking, and there'll probably be some legislation passed this year along that. But anyway,
let's talk to John now. Hi, John.
Hello.
Hi, John. Go right ahead.
Hi. I've been an attorney for about 40 years, and this past summer I found myself on a tour that included several days in St. Petersburg, Russia. And while I was there, about 15 to 20 protesters and demonstrators run a big public square there with signs and shouting and stuff. So I asked our Russian guide, I said, I didn't think protests were permitted like this in Russia. And then he proudly said, oh, yes, we have free speech in Russia. And then he added, as long as the government approves it. it was very interesting. He was so proud. And then I asked, well, what issue did the government approve for these demonstrators? And he said that Putin did not have enough power, that Putin should have more power. And so it was a real-life example of how we Americans, I believe, take our rights for granted. So I just wanted to pass on that story.
Thank you, John. We appreciate it. It is all a matter of perspective, isn't it, Judge?
That's right. That's right.
Or as you said earlier, it depends.
It depends.
513-419-7100. And Carrie joins us. Hi, Carrie. Hi, Carrie. Go right ahead.
Question. Each time my grade school kids sing, I'm a pastor here in Cincinnati, but each time my grade school kids sing a Jesus Christmas song at their public school, it drives me about nuts. And I was curious, what are the laws around public school speaking publicly and including, could this fellow who's possibly going to speak at UC speak at a high school? And what are the laws around somebody like that speaking there? I mean, I would think that'd be tough for a high school kid to try to deal with that.
So you mean somebody like Richard Spencer speaking at a high school? Okay.
Well, it's kind of the same that we've talked about before. If the school generally opens itself up to become, and this gets into legal wrangling or legal decisions that talk about traditional forum, public forum versus public forum versus a private area. But if a public entity normally opens itself up to be a place where different ideas are allowed to be expressed, then once they open themselves up for that, they cannot then restrict it based on the content of the speech that's going to be presented. I'm not sure that the public school system currently has a policy that allows them to open their doors to anyone who wants to come speak. If they do, then they have to allow everyone. If they have a policy that says we only allow certain groups to invite people in or during our assemblies, then that can be the policy that can be sustained. But once it's open to anyone, it has to be open to all.
Although the courts have been a little more apt to allow high schools to be more restrictive on speech. The standard is whether it disrupts the educational function, and courts have on some occasions taken that to, you know, I think a pretty extreme level. But, you know, earlier we were talking about, can speech be other than the spoken word? And one of the leading cases is a case out of a Des Moines high school where students wore black armbands to protest the Vietnam War, and that was recognized. They had the right to do it, but again, merely an armband. You know, it was certainly not speech in the traditional way that we see it. But the Supreme Court, again, Mark, you had said freedom of expression, recognized that even high school students have freedom of expression rights. So.
513-419-7100, and Jeremy has a question. Jeremy, go ahead.
Yeah, thank you for this discussion. Can you make comments on how this definition of fake news has impacted journalism in terms of the credibility? I'm really depressed that all of this great journalism, investigative reporting is going on, all of this great weight of research, and it's being minimized or de-minimized, however you want to say it. Why is this allegation that the press is so-called sending out fake news. I'd like to hear some comments from you.
Well, a question I would have is fake news a protected form of speech?
I think that's
if it is indeed occurring.
It depends. No, I think that it's fair to say, yes, it is. I mean, you know, it's like saying, is satire protected speech? Is comedy protected speech? Is hate speech protected speech? Fake news is information that's put out there. While it's deceptive and it's misleading and it can be insightful, as long as it does not cross the threshold of inciting some type of violent impact or violent effect, then I would argue, or I would say that in my courtroom, it would be considered protective. Not desirable, but certainly protective.
And I guess as long as it doesn't become libel or slander either.
That's a different issue of whether it's protected or not. But sure, in the context of whether or not it can be regulated, I think that it's protected in that way. Now, whether or not, as that's what I'm saying, there's a legal and a practical. From a practical standpoint, if you put some information out there, you might have the ability to say it, but there still might be a consequence for one's job for saying that. There still may be a consequence for the loss of family, friends, and opportunities. There still may be the consequence of being sued for saying certain things about people in the context that they're said in. But I think that as a general statement, fake news? Yeah, sure.
Well, for the most part, we regulate speech through civil proceedings, libel, you know, that sort of thing. However, there are some, you know, there are specific criminal laws about fraud, securities fraud. The Federal Trade Commission polices false advertising. The FDA polices false information about drugs and that sort of thing. The idea of the regulation, if you will, of fake news depends, you know, again, a definitional thing. There are some people who consider fake, you know, anything negative about me is fake news.
Anything, right? I disagree with is fake news.
Anything I disagree with is fake news. I do think, you know, there is fake news, however. There is news that is knowingly published, or it's news that's published or information that's published knowing it's false. And if in that situation, that is unprotected speech. The First Amendment would not stand in the way of even Donald Trump bringing a libel suit if he could prove that the person said something knowing it was false. Most of the time, that is not the case. Certainly, the media makes mistakes. They get bad information. But as long as they don't put it out there knowing it's false, they are protected by the First Amendment. So I think that's just an important thing to believe. I think the solution to Jeremy's point from a journalistic perspective is to just be very good, not take the bait, not, you know, get into debates about are we fake, are we not. Just journalists need to do their job. They need to nail down their sources. They need to nail down their information and just present the truth. And I think ultimately that will win out.
Thanks to everybody for joining me today.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mark.
Sana Hassan, staff attorney with the Council on American Islamic Relations Cincinnati, Hamilton County Municipal Court Judge Fannin Rucker, Jack Greiner, attorney with the Graydon Law Firm, and Dr. John Paul Wright, professor in the University of Cincinnati School of Criminal Justice. Beyond Civility will present When Hate Comes to Town, Rights, Risks, and Responsibilities tomorrow evening at the Hebrew Union College Jewish Institute of Religion. You can find a link to more information at wvxu.org.